The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and Don McIlvaney today. David, every year, a couple of times a year, you and your dad try to get away, sometimes to the furthest place away from everything else on earth so that you guys can strategize, you can regroup, you can banter about, maybe argue about China, and then maybe agree about Europe. But why don't you guys tell everybody where you're at?
Well, we're spending a couple of days in Hawaii, and as you say, looking at the world from a different perspective. We try to look at it from, take the aerial view, if you will, and both look at the details and the big picture and see where we have compatible ideas and where we disagree. And in our view, sort of iron sharpening iron in an effort to better understand the world and bring that big picture to our clients.
Well, and Don, it's good to talk to you again. You've been gone for about 4 months. You've been in Asia. I know you've been in the Philippines. You've been in Europe. So you're coming around from the other side of the world and sort of meeting David from the other side.
Yeah, it's good that we can kind of have these more or less international rendezvous. Kevin, we spent about 6 weeks over in Europe, you know, in Greece and Belgium, Switzerland, France, England, a few other places. And we did talk to financial leaders and leaders in the precious metals industry and got some interesting perspectives from Europe, and then went on down to India, Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, Hong Kong, and so forth, and got some interesting, sometimes contrasting views from leaders over in Asia. I would say the one conclusion I would make from my last 4 months' travels is the world is changing very, very, very rapidly, and I would say for the most part, it's deteriorating in a lot of ways.
Well, Dad, as we noted in last Friday's commentary, you know, there were several U.S. economic statistics which were positive for October and November. So good news may, in fact, keep markets stable through the year end. And this is an important point to make because we have both Wall Street and Washington looking forward to looking back, if you will, at 2011 as a positive event, as a note where we held it together. We had the poise of the boy on the burning deck. We saw Europe inflamed. And here in the U.S., we made all the right policy decisions. Can you see it now? The Dow is up 5% for the year, or if we can certainly finish above the 12,000 level, it'll be positive for the year, and they'll be able to pat themselves on the back. Frankly, we see it a little bit differently. Retail sales climbed less than forecast. You know, we saw electronics, clothes, autos, those were the areas that were bought here in the most recent couple of months. While people actually were cutting back on eating out at restaurants, probably no surprise, following Thanksgiving, and they were even skimping on groceries. So what we look at is this reallocation of limited resource, not the huge increase which pundits were looking for. And again, on the micro note, looking at the last couple of months coming into the end of the year, there are some good things to talk about, some positive notes, and that's what you're going to find certainly coming into the end of the year to make sure that the Dow finishes on a high note. That serves both the political purpose next year as well as Wall Street year-end gaming. That'll help them with their performance numbers and legitimize the fees that they're charging.
Well, and of course, I think the President administration would like to take credit for all the great rebound and so forth, which we think is a joke. It's interesting coming from a perspective looking at America from the outside back in as opposed from the inside looking out. And certainly being in a very, very financially and economically unstable region over the last few months over in stable region in England, UK, Europe, and so forth, and then going over to an area of extreme high growth over in Asia, we see things a little different maybe. I would say that what we're looking at is a short-term rebound in the U.S. economy, perhaps. I would say very short-term, if it's a rebound at all, because you can't trust any of the government numbers from unemployment to GDP to inflation, et cetera, et cetera. But if you take the longer view, looking out over the next 3, 6, 9, 12, 15 months, the humongous debt bubble that overhangs America has not gone away, just as we see it now causing major crisis throughout Europe. And what is a major financial economic crisis in Europe today, I think will be a major financial economic crisis in America within the next 6 to 12 months.
Well, and what we're seeing in terms of a global economy, and it's slowing down in concert, you sort of debunking that idea of decoupling, wherein emerging markets would lead us into recovery and into sort of the brave new world. You've got the global purchasing managers indexes, which are all moving down, two exceptions, the U.S. and Russia, where manufacturing is holding its own. but whether it's China, whether it's Germany, very important, and Brazil and a number of others, we're seeing a contraction in manufacturing. And we already see China out in front of this with a response, cutting reserve requirements and loosening its monetary policy to accommodate and perpetuate that growth. So we do see 2012 as a period of global economic recession, if not depression. And that is going to be fought with the two main tools that they have to draw upon, fiscal and monetary solutions. We're already seeing the experiment with the fiscal side and in Europe, and it's not working very well, not the least of because it's not popular. People don't like paying the price, and that's in terms of austerity. In terms of the government stepping up spending, then it's a question of who you're spending the money on and who is enfranchised. And this is really critical coming into 2012. As we've noted in the past commentaries, we've got over 50% of the G20 changing leadership next year. And so with that being said, how you spend money, how your fiscal authorities are outspending money, that's really important. Who was enfranchised, who was disenfranchised in the process? We look back at the wars that have been fought in Europe over the last 100 to 150 years, and we see that, yes, there was a political thematic, but behind the political thematic was an economic thematic. And this is something that we look at in terms of a very big picture view as being something to consider, war being an ingredient which will allow governments to spend an infinite amount of money without disenfranchising particular constituency groups. That's the problem with democracy, is unlimited government spending is a real challenge. It's not so much a question of how it's being spent, but whom it's being spent on. So something that chief economist at Nomura Securities over in Japan, Richard Koo, has pointed out, it's only in wartime that governments can spend any amount that they want on whatever they want with no electoral backlash. And we're moving into this period of extreme political change, and this is concerning to us.
Well, David, history repeats itself. We've been here before. The Great Depression was ended by World War II. And, of course, in any war, you've got to have viable enemies. You've got to have acceptance that the war is really the real deal by the peoples and all the nations involved and so forth. And because I think we are moving into a global recession, I think it's going to be a global depression. What do we do about that? Could the powers that be indeed be planning a war? And if so, who would the war be with? Who would be the enemy? Who is a viable enemy for the Western powers, which would be America, the UK, and Europe? Who can we fight? We don't want to have a war with Russia. They got nukes. We don't have a war with China. They have nukes. Who is a viable enemy? And here's what I believe. I think our planners are longer-term planners than sometimes we think, and I think they know that none of the financial, fiscal, debt piling up things that they're doing are going to work. So where's a viable enemy if we want to have a war to solve this global depression? Well, I think the viable enemy is in the Middle East, and I think this is the answer behind why America, Great Britain, and France have been in and have been destabilizing the Middle East by helping to overthrow governments throughout the Middle East, such as the Libyan government, Mubarak. We've seen Tunisia, Syria may go next, seen Yemen and so forth. And what's happening here? We're taking governments that are effectively neutral towards America, or like in the case of Mubarak and Egypt, who are even friendly towards America. We're destabilizing them. We're pushing those governments from power. And in behind them will come the Muslim Brotherhood and radical fundamentalists that will look much more like Iran. So what's happening is the whole Middle East is being fundamentalized, if I could use that word, is being radicalized, and the governments of stable, friendly to America, friendly to the West, governments are being pushed from power, and radical governments, which are going to align with Iran and the Muslim Brotherhood, are coming to power. You are consolidating an enemy in the Middle East, and I think this is why America, Great Britain, and the UK have been destabilizing the Middle East and pushing, who look like our friends, we're pushing them for power. I think we're creating the next enemy for the next major war, which is going to solve the depression that we're now finding ourselves in.
As we've talked about for the last 4 or 5 years, there is this step sequence between a financial crisis in which just a few institutions are implicated because of running their businesses very poorly or taking on too much leverage or whatnot, that morphing into an economic crisis where actual economies, not just one or two, but now we have a global economic crisis, and that ultimately creates a political crisis. So the step sequence of the financial to the economic to the political. That's where we're at now, front and center, 2012, 2013, with a change in leadership globally within the G20. You've got a political crisis where politicians are choosing winners and losers. Is it going to be the poor? Is it going to be the middle class? Is it going to be the rich that pay the price? And ultimately, when they find that their fiscal and monetary solutions don't work and just choosing winners and losers is not adequate, that's when they do push the nasty red button and go to war. So we end up with a geopolitical, world political crisis where we are scapegoating and blaming someone else for the problem, or just using conflict as a diversionary tactic. This is pretty commonplace if you're a student of history in seeing war as something that unites people. War is something that allows for that infinite spending of capital towards a quote-unquote positive end. And, you know, as you look at the ECB, they are finally joining the Fed, the Bank of Japan, the People's Bank of China, the Bank of England, the Swiss National Bank in currency debasement, because they're a lot closer now to everyone else. In spite of a philosophical predisposition towards conservatism, they now have the same problem that all these other central banks have. They're running out of options. So currency debasement is one of the last options, and we're seeing that globally. Following currency debasement, what do you have? Or when you begin to see currency debasement as the item at which constituency groups turn around and say, our government is screwing us and we don't approve of our government. Again, there has to be a reason to turn and say, no, it's not us, it's someone else.
Well, David, I saw some things that I found very troubling when I was in Europe over the last few months. The governments of Europe are, I think, in a panicky stage. And as they're panicking, what they're doing is they're taking their socialism and they're ratcheting up, and they are strangling the people with more and more socialist controls. They're moving towards currency controls, capital controls. They're imposing regulations more and more on the people. And so they're stifling the people because they're terrified that a massive amount of money is going to start exiting Europe. And indeed, that has begun. Even in Switzerland, and I've been a great fan of Switzerland for many years, but even in Switzerland, you now have the Swiss government under pressure from the EU and from the American government is now beginning to collect taxes for people from Great Britain and Germany. They're withholding like 30% taxes from their accounts. They are now reporting American, 11 banks now have said that they will report American depositors back to the U.S. government. And so one of the things I observed is, just as over the last 10, 15, 20 years, there has been a movement from socialist countries of personal, private, and business assets into Switzerland, now assets are beginning to move from Switzerland and Europe, and they're beginning to move over to Asia, to Singapore, to Hong Kong primarily. And so you've got a movement of funds out of Europe, and there's a perception around the world. Whether it's accurate or not, I don't know, but there's a perception that Europe, I think you could probably include the UK and America with it, is now the new socialist region or area, if you want, and the more free market region with less restrictions, more entrepreneurship, more freedom is out in Asia. So you've got a movement of funds, and indeed you're also seeing a movement of gold from the West to Asia, and the central banks and the IMF, and as the West has been selling gold in recent years, it's all being accumulated in Asia. China is now accumulating, the Chinese central bank is now accumulating 40 to 60 tons of gold per month, which is going into their reserves because they eventually hope to have a gold-backed reserve currency. There is kind of an interesting thing that the conservative money is beginning to exit Europe now and move over to Asia. Now, where it goes after Asia, I don't know. But there's just huge changes that are taking place. And I found that the new restrictions and the new strangling, freedom-strangling regulations that you're now seeing across Europe, I found that to be very, very ominous. I was quite troubled by what I saw in Europe.
Well, and following that same theme, at the same time, we find central bank purchases of gold steadily increasing. It's not just in China. In the third quarter, central banks were increasing their holdings. This is the third quarter of this year. Increased their holdings. It was a net increase of 148.4 tons. Those are the largest purchases in any one quarter, according to the World Gold Council, in 40 years. So it was twice last quarter's purchases and nearly seven times increase from a year ago.
Which says that the wave of the future is gold. Whether it's Europe, whether it's Asia, the wave of the future seems to be gold.
What that also says is the wave of the future is currency instability. where you know, central bankers, and this is primarily in your developing countries where they've had surpluses in past years, are taking some of their excess capital and putting it into metal. So you are talking about Asia, you're talking about Central Asia, you're talking about even Latin America. European demand, now this is non-central bank demand, but European demand, this is investors, savers, they're steadily increasing, again, according to the World Gold Council. In the third quarter of this last year, European demand for gold increased to 118 tons. That was in the third quarter. We previously mentioned the limited availability and the high premiums and prices paid on physical metals throughout the continent because we have operations in Europe. But these numbers do explain why consumers, investors, savers, all of them are concerned about the combination of fiscal and monetary options being considered, whether it's by the ECB or, frankly, by the U.S., and they're saying, frankly, a time in which we want to opt out. We just left to choose something else. So is it a pro-gold concern or is it an anti-fiat concern where they're just saying, hey, I'm not sure that anybody with a PhD is going to be making the best possible decisions, which is ironic because that's the only people making decisions in Europe today. It's the technocrats with PhDs, no real-world experience, but certainly a degree to show for, and certain reports that they've published through the years to show for, that legitimizes their presence as a decision maker today. I think savers and investors are right to say, not your life. I don't put confidence in them. Largely, it was the PhDs that got us into this problem. How are these same PhDs going to get us out?
You know, David, they used to say all roads lead to Rome. Well, in my opinion, almost all scenarios lead to a much higher price of gold. Whether we have a sovereign debt collapse or collapse of the European Monetary Union or simply an exodus of a number of countries, it spells instability. People will go into gold. If it's a deflationary scenario, if it's a massive inflationary scenario where they devalue all the currencies in Europe in order to fight back, all roads lead to gold. People will go into gold. If it's the war scenario that follows the economic recession, depression, whether it's an inflationary or deflationary depression, people will go into gold. So I see all these very, very unstable scenarios. None of us know exactly how they're going to work their way through, but they all lead to much, much higher prices of gold over the next few years, notwithstanding a correction that's been taking place in recent months in the price of gold. I think the world, people who understand, the thinking people of the world who understand the times and understand the gross instability economically, politically, financially, all over the world, they're going to go to the number one safe haven, and it's not going to be the dollar. It's not going to be the euro. It's going to be gold. So, gosh, I've never seen a scenario in my 40-plus years in the financial world and in the metals markets that is more bullish for gold and probably more bearish for the overall world economy.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Give us a call for the free December McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor called Meltdown in Europe, Prelude to Collapse in the West. Call us at 800-525-9556.
Well, the real game changer in the gold market comes when the bond market, the U.S. as well as European, if you want to look at German bonds, when basically sovereign paper, regardless of the country in question, is viewed as a risk asset. And at that point, those investors who had assumed that they made the right bet, the safe bet, the conservative bet, and now all of a sudden have to reconsider what risk actually is, yeah, that's where differentiation will be made, and gold as a currency alternative will stand out, not only against other currencies and against other safe haven plays like the U.S. Treasury market, but clearly as its old definition as a currency, not as a commodity. We would suggest that at this time, because of a slowdown coming into 2012 in the global economy, general commodities should be avoided. You look at the CCI, and it continues to weaken in lockstep with copper and other industrial metals. And again, this just follow the trail back. You've got consumer retrenchment, both in the U.S. and in Europe. That consumer retrenchment means that manufacturing demand for raw materials is going to decrease to match that end-user purchasing. And so any sort of inflationary, quote-unquote, repricing within the commodities complex is still a very future event. Be very cautious with the general commodities market, gold and silver being a real standout.
Yeah, to speak to silver, what do you think about silver? Silver's taken a pretty hard hit in recent months. What's your take on the silver market now, David?
Well, I think the worst is largely behind us, but that doesn't mean we couldn't have another 10 to 15% downside. I think sort of the 26 to 28 range would be your worst case scenario with the Dow shedding 1,000 or 2,000 points, with concerns over a deleveraging or a deflationary unwind. and gold taking a hit, silver taking a hit even more than gold. But I think what we're setting ourselves up for is a major boom in both metals. And I think this is where clients and thinking people have to look beyond the noise of the market action in a day, in a week, or even in a month, and see that some of these trends, which will ultimately take silver to $150, $200 an ounce and gold to over $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 an ounce, the pump is being primed even as we speak. Again, that game changer in the bond market where sovereign paper, today viewed as a riskless asset, will be viewed as it should be in a more accurate historical context as the only asset which offers return-free risk, if that makes sense. You're getting nothing. You're getting nothing and you're taking risk. That's the state that you're in as a Treasury buyer today, as a German bond buyer today. And as people realize that actually there are no fiscal solutions, there are no monetary solutions, there just is a restart which has to occur at some point. I think that reappraisal ultimately drives gold and silver to mind-numbing numbers, numbers that actually are not justifiable with the information we have today.
Well, David, you have an interesting perspective in that you have been in the precious metals business effectively all of your life, and you're also a money manager with your McIlvaney Wealth Management. And so clearly you and your clients are buying gold and silver. Okay, and we'll see banks and countries like China, like India, and so forth, accumulating gold for reserves and so forth. But my observation, and I get to see the world from a slightly different viewpoint, I just spent a large amount of time in India, and also I was just in China last week, about 10 days ago, and also in Singapore and throughout Asia. And my observation is that the man on the street, the man on the street in Asia, even poor people in Asia, and by the way, in Asia, we know that they save an incredible amount of money, having savings rates of 10, 15, 20, 30, 40%. I mean, people, individuals save money. They don't necessarily put it in the banks, but they save money. But those kinds of individuals, the man on the street in India and throughout Asia, as I observe, is buying gold and silver like there's no tomorrow. So we think of institutions, and in effect, you're an institution because you're a money manager, but I'm looking at the man on the street out in Asia, and they love gold and silver. They think it is really great. And so their savings, we save money and we put it in banks or IRAs or wherever and make a very low return. When they save money in Asia, in India, in China, in Singapore, in Hong Kong, they put it into gold and silver. And it's a huge difference. Now, I know some of that's happening in Europe, but I see it happening much more. And I think it's also happening in the Middle East. But I see it happening throughout Asia. And I marvel and think, boy, the next 10 or 15 years, they're going to own a lot of gold and silver. But, boy, what is that going to do for the price of gold and silver? It's going to be very helpful, I think.
Well, and, you know, on a relative basis, again, looking at equities, we'd like to see the year finish 5%, 7% above where it started, and it's likely to do that if we can get people to fixate on these few data points, again, sort of the October, November economic data points, which have been positive. And the relative comparison, however, still stands in stark contrast. Everyone looks at gold and says, well, it's significantly off its peak. That it's still up 18.5% since the beginning of the year. If we ended the year today, we'd be up $260 from where we began. That's 18.5% compared to a current 5% on the Dow. If you're looking at the transports, it's actually negative for the year. But, you know, again, on a relative basis, silver with the collapse from $50 to its current price is still 7% up for the year, even outperforming the Dow. So we're seeing the metals get a bad rap to some degree as we come into year end. But if you step back from the trees to see the forest, this has been one heck of a year. With all the things that have been happening globally, with the concerns that have been happening from a deflationary basis, it's actually been quite impressive.
David, I've observed over the last few weeks, a lot of the pundits on Wall Street, the people who, unfortunately, a lot of the masses like to follow, have been saying, oh, gold is a bubble. Gold has burst. Gold and silver, it's all over. Now, these are the people that when gold was at 253 and silver was down at 4, said by no means buy any gold. And throughout the entire rise, silver from 4 to almost $50 and gold to, I guess, around $1,900 from 253, they said, don't buy gold, don't buy gold, don't buy gold. Now those, and silver. And now those same people are saying, you see them in the press all the time, ah, see, we told you so, we told you so. The bubble has burst. Gold and silver are all over. How do you answer those people?
I think this comes back around to, again, what is gold but an anti-currency play or an anti-fiat play? And fiat money depends solely on one variable, confidence and trust, basically the same thing. And so to the degree that you have confidence in fiat money, the currency with zero backing to it, then there is no reason to own gold. But it's in periods of time where confidence is waning, and that's, again, as a result of poor fiscal and monetary policies, that people begin to lose confidence and trust. Here's the problem with confidence being lost. It generally takes a generation to regain that confidence. So you're not talking about confidence is gone today and it'll be right back tomorrow. We're talking about a change in the currency regimes that we've known in the post-World War II Bretton Woods era. I mean, so this is what's radical about what is happening today, is that no one has the imagination, an adequate imagination, for this trickle becoming a flood, not into gold, but out of fiat currencies on the basis of this breakdown in confidence, a breakdown in the people that we had assumed had all the answers. These are the folks in Washington. These are the folks in London. These are the folks in Tokyo. These are the folks travel through the world's capitals. They're supposed to have it together. They're supposed to be making the best decisions. When it turns out they're a bunch of dolts, guess what happens? Individuals say, I can't believe I was taken. And confidence is broken, not to return for many, many years, if not decades.
David, I've got a question for you. This is something I've pondered as I travel around the world. People in Asia, I think in the Middle East as well, and to a certain extent, at least with thinking people in Europe, they tend to buy fairly large percentages or invest a fairly large percentages of their portfolios in the precious metals. And as I said, out in Asia, there's many people in India and so forth that their entire savings are in precious metals. It's been my observation in the States that it's much less so, that, you know, I don't know what the percentage is, but I would guess that 1% to 2% of the American people, maybe it's higher now, have invested in precious metals. It's still a pretty low percentage as opposed to many other parts of the world. And I think it's significant that this bull market is not an American bull market. It's not being driven by America, although there is a lot of manipulation in the paper gold market and the part of Wall Street and so forth. But at what point do the Americans finally join the Asians and the people in the Middle East and say, my gosh, we need to be in precious metals, the currencies are failing us, and start going into the precious metals in mass, in much larger numbers of people and larger percentages of net worth? At what point does that happen, and what does that look like? What does that look like if and when it does happen?
To some degree, we have a very uneducated populace that is solely dependent on media, current media, for any information that they have. So whatever the media bias is, that is the taint, if you will, or the residual feeling that you're going to see in the marketplace. Whatever CNBC, whatever Bloomberg, whatever MSNBC, whatever all of these news agencies, if they have a bias, which they clearly do, whatever that bias is, that's going to be what is felt by the average person, as if that is reality, as if that defines reality. So, you know, confidence in the U.S. dollar, confidence in the U.S. economy, it's going to be there probably longer than it should be.
David, are the American people going to miss this bull market in gold and silver? Good grief, when we see silver go from $4 to $50, it's backed up now, and gold go from $253 to $1,900 and so forth, and the American people have largely missed this bull market because they've listened to their trusted leaders on Wall Street. Did they miss the market completely? Is it possible that this bull market will go for the next how many years and that the American people never really do get in?
Well, I think the Americans who will participate, like any thinking person around the world who has participated or will participate in the future, it'll be on the basis of them doing their own analysis and their own decision-making to the degree that they have deferred that out to someone else, either to do the heavy lifting for them intellectually and think through these things for them, or make those decisions, the critical financial decisions that individuals and families need to be making to preserve capital. If that's been deferred, I'm afraid that they will be left out completely. So the few people who have participated in the U.S. market and the many, many who have globally, these are people who do their own thinking, do their own research, do their own homework, are constantly curious and asking questions, and are always trying to overturn rocks for tidbits of information that will help them make wise decisions. Because at the end of the day, they have to make those choices. Those people will, as they have already, do incredibly well in the coming years in the context of a precious metals bull market. Whether that's 2 years, whether that's 3 years, whether that's 7 or 10 years, the one issue that I have, Dan, in looking at this bull market, distinct from the 1970s and coming into 1980, 1982, is we are talking about a monetary regime change on a global basis. Not just the U.S. dollar, but the way fiat money is looked at globally. That is in flux right now. And I don't know that we're going to have the boom-to-bust cycle in the precious metals where things get out of control on the price side and then collapse on the other side. We may, in fact, have an out-of-control move and the restabilization of all fiat by this plateau of a price pegged at whatever number that is, whether that's 5 or 10 or 15,000, whatever the number is to sort of balance the national accounts, so to say. And this is something that the IMF, the BIS, the Bank of International Settlements, the World Bank, will be very involved in terms of the decision-making of how gold is reintegrated into the monetary system. It's going to happen to some degree. We don't know to what degree, but it's going to happen as fiat currencies are delegitimized. We're going to see gold and silver, gold specifically, remonetized as a means for re-legitimizing fiat currency.
Well, David, taking the lead on that, whether you're a believer that China is going to be very strong in the future or not, China and the Chinese government and central bank are accumulating gold at such a rapid rate. The information we get from financial people we talk to out in Asia is that they really do believe that one day they could have a world reserve currency, a gold-backed reserve currency, and they're buying this gold at unprecedented rates. They've tripled their gold purchasing over the last 4 months versus what it was the year before. So they believe that gold is going to be back in the monetary system, and I think they visualize, rightly or wrongly, that they are going to play a leading role in that world monetary system with their own gold-backed currency.
Well, UN Security Council, let's go back to your point earlier about there being a solution which is neither monetary nor fiscal in nature, but military in nature. If Europe, Western Europe, the U.S., the U.K., are embroiled in a conflict in the Middle East, what side do the Chinese take?
Oh, that's a really scary question. I believe that the Chinese will come in on the side of the Middle East, the Middle Eastern powers. I believe that Russia will too, and most of what we call the former communist countries. I call it the new axis. We know who the old axis was in World War II, Germany, Japan, Italy, Spain, and so forth. But the new axis, I believe, which will be aligned against the Western powers, some people tend to call them the New World Order powers, the U.S., the U.K., and Europe. And the new axis on the other side, I think, will be the Middle Eastern powers, Russia, China, and so forth. Now, I don't know if the powers that be in America and the West understand that this is how it could go. I do believe that they're intentionally setting the stage for a war, which may bail them out of this emerging depression. I don't think they've calculated what happens in that scenario if two major nuclear powers, Russia and China, come in on the side of the designated enemy, which is the Middle East. That could turn very, very ugly indeed, and a world war that is a very programmed, manageable world war, kind of a minor regional war, if you will, suddenly gets out of hand and turns literally into a full-blown world war, only in the nuclear age. That's a very negative scenario. It's a little ominous.
The only thing I think I'd probably disagree with you on that in terms of my opinion is the ties that Europe has to Russia and the revenues that Russia gains from that economic compatibility with Europe, I think would probably tie their interests financially in something that's more Western-oriented than Eastern-oriented, if you will.
I respect your opinion on that, but I would counter with the fact that I think the Russians love Europe and would love to merge with Europe. In fact, I think they would still love to rule Europe, but they hate America. But they hate America, and herein lies the problem. America and Europe are allied together. Now, we do know that Russia is very closely allied with the Middle Eastern powers. Indeed, most of their major weapons that are going into Iran now are coming from Russia, some from China, some from North Korea, and so forth. And what I've observed, geopolitically speaking, now let me change hats, over the years is anyone who is America's enemy is Russia's friend. I don't think that's changed since the alleged fall of communism in 1991. I think Russia is still our enemy. It will do anything in our power, especially under someone like Putin, to undermine America and our interests. So I still believe that Marxists will go with Marxists, and therefore Russia and China will be in the same camp. I think they always have been in the same camp, as a matter of fact.
Well, we've got a change in leadership in China this next year. We've got a change with the Russians. We've got a change here in the United States. Let's finish with sort of a political insight coming into 2012 before the tone and tenor of the race and the specific people involved become the dominant theme. What are your thoughts in terms of the election, Republicans versus Democrats? If you had to speculate and place a bet on who wins and why, what would you guess?
Well, I think you and no one will like my answer, and I hope this opinion is wrong, but I believe Obama will be reelected. I believe he'll be reelected because he has massive, massive money in his campaign chest. George Soros, I think, has already kicked in $1 billion, and so there's no lack of funds. I think the media is about 98% tilted towards the Democrats and towards President Obama. I think the Republicans have been systematically killing each other off in the primaries, and those who would have been conservatives that I would have supported or could have maybe supported have in fact been sliced and diced by the media and by the political left. And the only one left standing is Ron Paul, who's a great man and a good friend. They couldn't slice and dice him because he's too clean, so they basically have just tried to kill him off by ignoring him. So now they've narrowed it down to Romney, who is a liberal and an establishment person, and Newt Gingrich, who is a liberal and an establishment person. And it looks like Newt Gingrich could get the nomination, but as Nancy Pelosi has already said, they will tear him apart, and they will come out and reveal all of his background. Well, he was fined $300,000 while he was Speaker of the House for unethical behavior, and he quickly resigned from the House of Representatives. So that's pretty unusual when a Speaker of the House suddenly resigns, as he did. And, of course, he's had a lot of marital infidelity, affair-type problems that have been very public. And so the Democrats will become very, very righteous. They will put on their righteous hat, and they, I believe, will tear him to pieces. So I think just as the Republicans managed to pick up the weakest candidate possible in John McCain in the last election, I think they're likely to do this again. And whereas I think Herman Cain would have had a reasonable chance against him. He was a black man. He's a businessman, pretty conservative, pretty knowledgeable. I think he would have had a good chance. Michelle Bachmann was certainly a conservative. Ron Paul would be tremendous. They've just ignored him. And so systematically, I think the establishment has eliminated everybody but their designated choices. In my opinion, which I've stated in my newsletter, David, on a number of occasions, is I think the establishment basically picks a designated winner and loser who are somebody on both sides, the Republican and Democrat side, who are acceptable to them. If our designated loser happens to win, it's okay because he was pretty sympathetic to us. I think when a lot of Newt Gingrich's CFR background and the fact that he was a creator who was created almost like the dust out of the earth, like Adam, by David Rockefeller, by the Rockefeller family many years ago, and a lot of that surfaces, there's going to be lukewarm support for him. I think you put all these things together, in spite of the fact that the economy is very much against Obama, and he's a president, they can control events, they can control many, many things. If I had to bet money, I would reluctantly place my bet on Obama and say that he will probably be reelected next year.
Well, here's the interesting thing. If we're right in sort of the 2014 to 2016 time frame is where we begin to see an intensification of events from a financial and economic standpoint, where there may in fact be some resolution and an opportunity to re-enter the equity markets because the worst is at that point behind us, which would imply that there's a lot more still ahead of us that represents downside, then guess what? Whoever takes the election in 2012, the probability of that party coming back to office within a generation is very, very low. So the Republicans, if they get hung with the cross, so to say, in this election, they may win and they'll lose for a generation. If the Democrats win and they may lose for a generation, because what happens over the next 3 to 4 years is likely to be something that a generation cannot and will not forget.
Well, I can't disagree with anything you just said. I would simply say if the present powers that be remain the powers that be, I fear what they will do to the Constitution and many, many of our freedoms in a second term, and that is a great concern to me. I hear what you say, that you know, if there's a Great Depression and it falls on their watch, then yes, they can be discredited for years. But there's the issue of the Constitution, freedom, regulations, control, and so forth, and I think they have been accelerating in the wrong direction under the present regime, and I think will accelerate even faster if they get a second term. So I look at the political considerations, long-term political considerations, as well as the economic, financial. I would just say we need to pray for our country. We're really a big mess. I would say, I know we're running out of time here, David. I would just say that do what you can for the country. Do what you can and be really thoughtful about who you support in this election if they give you a choice. But in the meantime, and as I've written a lot in the last 6 months in my own newsletter, make your own personal preparations, family, financial, economic preparations, as if we were going into tough times, as if you were on the Gulf Coast of Texas and you knew the hurricane was coming, you saw it coming, but you had advanced warning, you were able to batten up the hatches and move to higher ground and take defensive actions to protect yourself. I think this is what you need to do. And in the remaining 6, 12, 18 months of stability, if we have that much, I would say make the preparations financially. Position yourself to go through a longer-term period of instability so that you have protected your assets and are one of the people that are able to come out the other side and help rebuild the country, because you have protected and preserved your own assets.
Well, David and Don, I really appreciate you letting us just sort of eavesdrop in on the conversation. Don, your newsletter was really excellent. Every newsletter is. The December newsletter, however, is something that we can offer the listeners if they'd like to call in. You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and Don McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or, if you'd like the newsletter, give us a call at 800-525-9556, and we'll send you the December McIlvaney Intelligence Advisor for free. It's called Meltdown in Europe, Prelude to Collapse in the West.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.